friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and actually we, to catch up with Dr. Maureen Murphy, let's go to the Leader Kranz Club on 87th Street in Manhattan. Today, of course, being an all-day event, which is never any problem for you, Dr. Maureen Murphy. But today is a special day for the American Irish Teachers Association. Their annual meeting takes place there today. You're very welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Adrian.
Now, Maureen, your bio covers a half a dozen pages, and I would figure it's around 8 minutes of airtime, but I'll make some comments along the way. But the reason that we would, in particular, like to welcome you to the program this morning, some people may not know that you have actually headed the centenary celebrations, the preparations, indeed, of some of which have already been underway for the centenary of the 1916 Rising, and in fact, the 100th anniversary of the Rising in Ireland has particular resonance in the United States. You might indeed just give us an outline of this great connection with the U.S. and the 1916.
Sure, sure, Adrian. I'm actually just the secretary. I sort of called people together to just so that we would make a program of all of our events. And it's been a great opportunity. Of course, you've been part of it, and Onion's been part of it, to for people in the Irish American community to come together and to plan and to know what we are doing, what each other's organizations are doing, with the idea that we will be able to support each other and support our efforts. At this point, we are just about ready to go to press with the program, and we'll continue to update it electronically. But at this point, for example, we have 64 events that are going on here, plus 22 events that will be part of the I Am Ireland series coming over. So it's a very, very full program. And in answer to your question about the Irish American dimension here, three events to bring to mind, but one of them is the work that John Ridge is doing with the Irish counties, United Irish Counties,
yes,
in investigating the part played by the various United Irish counties in planning and supporting the Rising. We know most of the signatories lived a period, like Tom Clark living out in Manorville, but many of the rest of them visited. Conley, of course, lived here, lived in Troy, and lived in New Jersey. But McDiarmid came, Pierce came, Roger Caseman came out. So there were all kinds of visits, and the county associations particularly stepped up to the plate. We have, at the American Irish Historical Society, we're opening it on the 19th of April, is a special exhibition of the archives, the 1916 archives of the American Irish. There were two co-conspirators, if you will, Daniel Florence Cohalan, who was a New York State Supreme Court judge. Interesting, his interest in politics, which some people in the law fraternity tell me would be frowned upon today. But Judge Cohalan was front and center with his great friend John Devoy. And in March of 1916, they convened the Irish Race Convention in New York at the Hotel Astor with 2,300 participants. And from that, they proposed and brought through something, a group called the Friends of Irish Freedom, which were again instrumental in helping with the financing of the 1916 Rising. important group. We are going to have, as I say, the United Irish County is doing a brochure on the county parts. We're going to have a symposium at New York University. Gluckspin, Ireland has New York University,
yes,
on the, again, the Irish-American connections. And then, modestly, I say, on the 14th of May, closest to the date of Sean McDermott's execution, we're going to have a little symposium on the Irish-American women, like Gertrude Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Sean McDermott's sister, Rose McDermott, she used the English form of her name, worked at the Mission of Our Lady of the Rosary for the protection of Irish immigrant girls. You know my great interest in that. Well, Rose McDermott was the business manager, but she also appears in the Carmelite archives as somebody who was very involved in planning various events around the city. So I'm hoping, Adrian, that in the work that we're doing with our events and in the year, that one of the things that we're going to be doing is identifying and celebrating the participation of the Irish American community in,
yes,
the planning and the support of the Rising. And we tend to think of it, and I've been encouraging people to think of this, more as history than celebration, that this, we're really concentrating on the history for the sake of our young Irish Americans. In fact, one of the things I'm doing at the Irish American Conference, the American Irish Teachers Association Conference, is doing some new lessons, and I've done a three-linked lesson on the 1916 Proclamation. The first looks at the proclamation, the second compares it with the Declaration of Independence, and the third links it with a very interesting young adult novel called Friend or Foe, Which Side Are You On? A very nice, mm-hmm, little novel about in Dublin, a young woman whose dad is in the Irish Volunteers and her best friend, Jack, father, is in the Dublin Municipal Police, and
mm-hmm,
and it's a very interesting little novel about loyalty and about these two working out that sense. So what we're trying to do is engage our young people in the Irish American dimensions of 1916 and remind our older folks that we had a part to play in New York, not in Dublin, but in New York.
My guest, friends, is Dr. Maureen Murphy, Professor of Curriculum and Teaching, Director of Secondary English Programs, Co-Director of the Undergraduate Irish Studies minor at Hofstra University, served as Interim Dean of the School of Education and Health Human Services, the university's Dean of Students for more than a decade, and Acting Chair of the Department of Curriculum and Teaching. Maureen, I want to take you back to a period, how quickly time moves on. As you were director of the Great Irish Famine Curriculum Project for the New York State Department of Education, and the Great Irish Famine Curriculum of 2001 won the Project Excellence Award from the National Council for of the Social Studies in 2002. You've served as Vice President of the New York State English Council. You've written more than 100 articles and book chapters, delivered more than 300 lectures in 18 countries, a Fulbright Fellow in Dublin, from 1965-66, State Department lecturer to Egypt in 93, a fellow in Humanities Institute, University College Dublin, awarded an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters by the State University of New York, and that's in 2002. When you hear rattling off just some of the acknowledgments and awards which you have duly deserved, was there a time, and can you pinpoint a time when your interest in Ireland, in Irish studies, in all things Irish, became a part of you which you couldn't get away from?
Yeah, when I was 9 years old, I did my. We had to do a booklet about a country. Of course, I chose Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the Sunday edition, I suppose it would be the New York News, had a feature on Ireland and a big map of Ireland with the names of places. And I still have that. I drew pictures. The little essay was probably plagiarized from one of the encyclopedias, but, you know, just copied out. But that very clearly. The other thing is my grandmother was an upstairs maid. She came to America from Ballinamuck, County Longford, and she lived with us, and I had tea with her every afternoon, and so that certainly was part of it. And as people, I always say to people, I always thought I was Irish until I went to Dublin, and that's when I discovered I was an American. But, I mean, in our kind of ethnic Catholic parish, there were the Irish and the Italians, you know, the usual, the Germans, the usual mix that we had in the 40s and 50s. And as far as I was concerned, we were Irish and not anything else. So it was very much part of my identity. My maiden name was O'Rourke, and I married a Murphy, so hardly a change, but always very, very, very much part of my identity.
You know, for those of now that I am more than 55 years in this country here, even when my memory was sharper than it is today, I do know that growing up in the west of Ireland, there wasn't much reference to 1916, and that was kind of for good reason. You're talking about, again, the growing up the 40s, 50s in Ireland. It was not part of the curriculum in the national school. And in fact, for those of us who went on to boarding school, to secondary schools in Ireland, by the time you got there, any chance there might have been of learning and studying Irish history that was so recent as 1916, that was overpassed as well, and we were onto European history and whatever. Paint the picture here for around the same time. Let's go get into the 50s and into the 60s. Was there much said in the home, in the houses, or was there a tendency in amongst the Irish Americans and some of the relatively recent Irish immigrants at the time, was there a reluctance to bring it up? Was there a level of interest? Or was that pretty much confined to songs and poetry and whatever? Just
I would think the latter, Adrian. I think it was certainly my here in for me in the 50s and 60s. It was Irish. That was when the Clancy brothers first came.
Yes.
And we loved the, you would know them, of course, but we loved the ballads, and we discovered that and had wonderful time. I played guitar. Don, my husband, and I played instruments. My brothers, we all sang. And so that was very much a part of things. With less interest in the politics. My grandparents came right at the turn of the century, the 20th century. So they were here in 1916. I, in fact, was in Dublin in 1965 and 66, so I was in Dublin for the Jubilee, for the 50th anniversary.
Absolutely,
And what I remember about it, Adrian, was that in those years, not everybody had a television. Television was very special.
Sure.
And people, companies or shops offered televisions for rent mm-hmm. for the week of the 1916 commemoration. And, of course, once the television came into the house, it didn't go out again.
Right.
But I remember that Irish television did two things. They had a You Are There kind of program
mm-hmm.
every night that followed the rising from the countermanding orders or casemen coming in and so forth
yeah.
until the surrender on Friday. And then later in the evening, this was a big deal because RTE really, this is the most ambitious thing that they'd done. They spent a great
right.
deal of money. But oddly enough, Adrian, the more interesting and more moving thing from my point of view was, I think at 9 o'clock, they had one, every night they had a cluster of people talking about one of the men who was executed. And the most moving was Nora Connelly, you know, a big plain woman, sort of sitting there speaking not a monotone, but a voice without a lot of inflection. But she told the story of the British soldiers coming to the door of their home, herself and her mother, to her mother, to say if she wanted to see Connelly once more, that they would take her over. And he, I believe, was in Dublin Castle. I don't think he was in Kilmainham.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Mrs. Connelly took Nora, who would have been not a schoolgirl, but maybe 14 or 15. And Nora Connelly describes driving through the burning city across the Liffey to Dublin Castle and finding her father on probably on a gurney or on a cot, and her mother saying, "Oh, Jim, you're wonderful, your wonderful life." And he said, "Lily, don't cry, you'll unman me." And then she said, "Oh, but you know, what a wonderful life." And he said, "Yes, but wasn't it a wonderful life?" But I mean, but to hear Nora Connelly do this in just this very understated voice, so absolutely so moving. And Connelly, in some ways, really emerged. It was the times that were in it. It was a time of kind of a social revolution and so forth. So that his politics emerged very sympathetically that week. And
yeah.
It's funny, Pierce's people, he never really became human. He was most human by, I think Desmond Ryan talked about him, people who knew him as schoolboys. He had a real, he had a sense to them. But it was Connelly who came through in the most direct way and certainly affected I was a graduate student, but these were the younger university students, the undergraduates, very, very taken with Connelly.
You know, when the Irish government became involved in what would be and what is coming up, the centenary, the 100th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, the Embassy of Ireland in Washington, and in fact the 6 consulates general across the United States, began preparing the program covering political, economic, cultural events across the United States. Now, you had to be aware when you were, let me say, I'm trying to think of a better expression than roped in, but actually I'll stick with that one. When you were selected to plan the commemorative program for the greater New York region, you must have, indeed from your own experience, known that there was going to be a great number of, well, first of all, the events were going to lead to a degree of controversy. There was a backlash, in the United States about the fact that the Irish government should be, stuck in this in the first place. And in fact, many criticisms across the board that, in fact, the Irish government was going to try to downplay this centenary and would be very happy when it's over and done with. Now, maybe you didn't. I know that I had, a number of reservations and expectations that it would be very difficult to get everybody on the same page, as it were. And obviously, there is still room for many of those who don't agree in fact there should be any whitewashing of the events as they were. And yet when you're in Ireland, or for those who came from, there were many areas of Ireland that could hardly claim any victory at all, or in fact there were some areas of Ireland that weren't involved whatsoever in it. Was that something, does that bear historical fact?
Well, Adrian, for one thing, I think you and Anya and I, when we were involved with the Unger Memorial and other kinds of projects around town, we've often said it would be helpful if we in the community got together and from time to time met to draw up a little calendar of our event,
right,
so that we would know what's going on. I know you do so much on your program to publicize events, but even to have something in the hand so we could know what's going on, and sometimes even to say to one another, well, you know, could we just shift this around? We're all doing something on this particular night. Is
right.
there any flexibility? And what I did, I wasn't selected. I volunteered to do something very simple, and I volunteered to put together a calendar of events and to call together people in the community to come together so we could map out the centenary year, so that we could support each other's events, so that we could avoid conflicts, so that
Absolutely.
We could attend the things that we wanted to attend. The other thing I was, so that was one thing. The second thing, Adrian, was my what I call my big tent theory, and that is in the Irish American community here, we are not as tied up as people in Ireland with political considerations and so forth. So we could make the biggest tent possible. And as far as I'm concerned, any organization that lets me know what they are doing, I'm not making any editorial decisions. Everybody's
right.
welcome. We have events on the program that represent various interests, cultural, political, geographical.
Right.
But that's really, it's, I sort of, smile when people say I'm the chair. I'm not the chair. All I did was volunteer to put together the calendar. And so people came together. I did reach out to people to come together. And I think, and you've been in, and Anya's been present at some of those meetings, and we've had some of them at the consulate because it's a good central location.
Yes.
And people who don't ordinarily see each other came and sometimes would spend a little time having perhaps a cup of tea or a glass of water after the meeting and chatting and catching up. And it was a chance for people in the community. I mean, we all tend to be involved in a group of activities.
We, yeah.
We're not involved in every single activity, but we're involved in our own, you know, little cluster of three or four things,
sure.
perhaps. So it was a chance for us to meet one another and to talk about, you know, what we're doing. And I have found that a very valuable experience, quite apart from the centenary thing. And we will have a calendar,
yeah.
Or a program, rather. But I think the most useful thing is people who don't ordinarily have a chance to talk together.
Right.
Because of this occasion, I think you could see that when we were gathered
people would
chat away who, you know, the GAA talking to the Bratton Laws or the AOH
yeah.
talking to the county society. I'm just giving you those as
yes.
examples
yeah.
coming out of my head. So I think that has been very, very useful for the Irish American community.
I think one of the side effects of this is in the process of getting together and talking about the events, the centenary events, we found ourselves actually already getting into, by mid-September, the Irish Women Writers of Symposium.
That's right.
We also found, that the Hudson Valley Irish Fest.
Exactly.
That is so many groups and, again, areas of what might have been of concern and say, well, the centenary is going to be all centered around Easter week and that'll be the height of it. This proved to be absolutely wrong in the sense that we are talking about an actual a heavy duty calendar of events which will lead up to and way beyond the Easter week and the
Exactly. For example, we have 18 events in April, but I mentioned that we have that so far we have 64 events through the year, and obviously that about a third of them would happen in April should not be a surprise to anyone.
Right.
But the nice thing is that two thirds are at other times throughout the year.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that's a point that you make that's well taken.
It's also, when we think and acknowledge the great influence and support of Irish America, and again, this is across the United States, but the bulk of that indeed seems to be concentrated on the New York, the tri-state area. Mm-hmm. It may, for once and for all, educate all of us that when we're talking about the support that the Rising got from the United States, we're not talking about the passing of the hat. And that, of course, obviously was very much a part of it. But there was a much deeper association and affiliation at that particular time. And obviously, if you have five of the seven signatories either coming here or living here or spreading their influence here, they were going back with more than, bucketfuls of money.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And that's where I think there's a lot of room for those who might feel that this was not just the whip around, in the pubs and everybody. Sometimes we get conflicted in that because of our songs and because of the rah-rah associated with it, with all of this. But there was a lot of, and there still is, a lot of interest, again, in the contribution, the international contribution, and in fact, in the proclamation itself. The United States is the only foreign country referred to.
Yeah, that's one of the things in this series of lessons I'm doing for the Irish teachers. One of them is to ask the students to investigate when the exiled children in America, what was that contribution? That's what they're doing.
Right.
And in another lesson, I asked the students to commit. It's a lesson that I'm very engaged with. To compare the Declaration of Independence with the 1916 Proclamation. These are the kind of lessons, Adrian, in this new core curriculum, which is very text-centered. They want students to read informational text and know from the text exactly what they mean, and they're particularly interested in what they call foundation texts, foundation American texts, and so that we use things like the preamble to the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address. So I've used the first two paragraphs, the important two, first two paragraphs of the Constitution here. And so that's another aspect, is looking at those. But I wanted to make one other point, Adrian, and I think this is really telling about the Irish-American community. After the Rising, the Irish-American community were really, for one thing, some of our events involved people who didn't really approve of the Rising. They were nationalists. They didn't approve of the Rising. That's part of my Big Ten theory.
Mm-hmm.
But we had people after the Rising who were concerned about the welfare of the families and dependents of people who were sent to prison, or, of course, people who were executed. And in November of 1916, they had a big bazaar. Nora Conley came out to open it to raise money. And I don't think anything comparable was done in Ireland. It was in America. And, again, it was that kind of real compassion for the families who would have been in very, very dire circumstances with executions or with imprisonment. So, that's another thing. And then Mrs. Pierce, in our archives of the American Irish Historical Society in 1917, there are letters, handwritten letters from Mrs. Pierce, because they did a whip around to try to save St. Enda's when it was in danger of being dismantled. So, again, the Irish-American community, it was the kind of whip around, yes, but it was...
Yeah.
It wasn't a political thing.
Right.
In this case, it was a compassionate thing. Mrs. Pierce writes very movingly that this was Patrick Pierce. I mean, he spent his life, and of course, he'd been out to America to raise money for St. Enda's, but they really rallied around and to try to save the school. And then, of course, they did this terrific bazaar. I'm hoping that will be part of, I can get somebody to do a paper on that for our May 2016 gathering on Irish-American women, because Marion Casey's done wonderful work on these
Irish
women's
bazaars. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if there's stuff on this 1916, but we do know that it happened. So that's another little point I wanted to make about the that outreach, as you know from the famine, there was that outreach right along there to help out to the people less fortunate.
Yeah, and it should not be a surprise when we look at the influence of again the church, the Catholic church, and some would say, well, that's an easy one, because that's where the Irish were, Irish Americans were going to meet anyway. But there's some, surprises along the way. The involvement and the concern about human rights.
That's right.
And again, as you mentioned a couple of times, the women. They were very much a part of the support group as well. And in hindsight, that must have been, pretty gutsy to have involved the church, and to allow the church actually to be, a center for, something that wouldn't have necessarily... gotten a round of applause at that time. But the truth of the matter was that maybe, in addition to the great organizations, including the United Irish Counties and many that you've already mentioned, that the church actually became a place, too, where the rallying of support was not at all a secret.
Well, I think a great model of the church and is the mission of Our Lady of the Rosary that took care of 100,000 Irish girls who came through the Port of New York. And you'll be interested, as a Mayo man, you'll be interested to know the the exhibition has traveled to Turlock Park, to the Folk Museum near Castlebar.
Absolutely.
It was supposed to stay till March, but Rosa Meehan wrote me to say, could they keep it till July? It's such a success. And it's a success because that wraps around an inner exhibition of migrant women who have come to Ireland from other places.
Right.
So there are artifacts of that and then little video loops of these women talking. But but the model for this was the church, the generosity of the church in it's a model of making migrants welcome.
Yes.
And of course now with the European migration, this is so important at a time when governments seem to be a bit lost about how to handle this challenge.
But also, if we come to say 1916,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in the large cities like New York and Boston, and I'm only picking a couple from the East Coast here, the Irish immigrant was barely, the turnaround. They were now being perceived as not this uneducated, unruly, bunch. In fact, that the Irish had, by the turn of the century, they were rising in the social sphere as well.
Yeah.
So it would have been, interesting, in the lead up, we're talking to at a time when here are the Irish, now they have this new respectability that of a mantle that, was now disappearing. Again, born, I would say, by newer groups of immigrants coming in and the social ladder. So we were just coming into our own. So it was very interesting that we were only talking about 100 years ago.
That's right.
And that's an eye-opener as well.
Yeah. I was just teaching Brian Friel's translation to my Ireland Inside Out class and talking to them about the national school and the standard of the national school.
Yes.
Of course, you'd know that with parents who are national school teachers.
Yeah.
But the level of education and the I did a study one time of national school books, and just the level of language in those books, and so that they came out to America usually with a very, very good good national school education.
Foundation, yeah.
Very good foundation, and that's why after the Second World War, when the GI Bill was available, so many of bright Irish-American men who had good, good foundation and maybe had gone to a parochial high school they just took like ducks to water when it took the GI Bill and ran
with
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Our first generation in the American Conference for Irish Studies were mainly guys who got their education on the GI Bill.
And, that's just one. First of all, that's a great observation and one that I think we've kind of become used to. So, the calendar.
Yes.
The program is one which is being added to. Just for curiosity, you were talking about electronically updating.
Yes.
Which, if we go back to September, we were saying, listen, we really ought to get all of this in, hopefully by the end of September.
Yeah.
And... And,
well, there were some delays that I hadn't anticipated.
Well, and there will be, I'm sure, a lot of, additional events that are going to take place. So it will be, it will be good too.
That's
and everybody
right.
is invited. I know that you have, pounded into all of us that you are not chairing a selection committee as to, you know, how events are going to be commemorated, celebrated, that this is not part of it, that actually we want to know and we need to know what events are taking place. And
exactly.
And some may be as different as chalk from cheese. Having said that, it's going to be a very interesting centenary and a very good year, and one that, you know, I think will rally a lot of support beyond the Irish-American community. And, you know, when we think of the tremendous influence of, you know, the Irish famine and the curriculum, getting that into, say, the New York State curriculum, there will be, you know, by the time 2016 not only rolls around, but there will be a lot of new information. Some of it is old as the hills, but there will be some revelations that, in fact, will, when all is said and done, give a great balance.
I think so.
And this is important.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
I thank you for your time. I know that you are very busy today, and we wish you luck. I know that a lot of some of the people down there, we're very well known when the American Irish Teachers Association, and in particular, I know John and Anne Garvey.
Oh, yes.
They're very much a part of
absolutely
many of the organizations. Again, thank you, and we will continue.
Good.
As the time goes by, and I really again want to thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Adrian.
Thank
always
you.
A pleasure.
Friends, Dr.
Okay.
Maureen Murphy. And you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.